third case?
May it please the court, I'll try to be brief. The first thing I wanted to mention is that I realized in preparing for argument that we had transposed appellant's points of error so that when we start off with points of error 1 and 2, that really should be points of error 2 and 3. And when we talk about point of error 3, that should really be point of error 1. So we apologize. And if you'd like, I do an amended brief or I could do an errata, which the court would prefer. But what I want to talk to the court today about is point of error 1, which is discussed in our brief at pages 14 through 30. This is the point of error about appellant possessing a long story about incest between a father and his prepubescent daughter, where both the actors had the same names as the victim and the defendant in our case. Appellant makes two different arguments, as I understand it, in his brief. The first is that the story is just the judge lacked the discretion to find this was relevant under traditional 401 and 404B analysis, basically because things like it wasn't shown that the defendant wrote the story. And we rely on our brief for our discussion. We think we've provided ample authority for the...
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The appellant argues that the trial court held he didn't have standing to object to the story because there was no showing it was his. Is that right?
Well, that's an entirely different... He filed a motion to suppress based upon the search warrant, and the defendant complained that it was a... His suppression motion was that it was a personal writing, which you can't get under a search warrant, and the defendant refused to say in the suppression hearing that it was a personal writing. And so the judge really didn't have standing for that suppression motion. Now, there's no point of error on that topic on appeal, so I haven't addressed it on appeal.
Do you understand how confusing it is, though, to say it's admissible because it was his writing, but he doesn't have standing to challenge it because it's not his writing?
I'm not relying upon it being his writing. If it had been a magazine, it would be equally as admissible as if he wrote it. So our argument is not contingent upon him having written it.
But, I mean, you have standing to challenge the things that are yours in the sense of in your possession or something that you have an expectation of privacy in that you put in your locked desk drawer or whatever.
Well, I haven't briefed this issue because it wasn't raised, but as I understood, the trial judge was saying that if you want to say that it's not admissible under this personal writing exception to the search warrant statute, then you have to say it was a personal writing and the defendant wouldn't do it. Now, I don't really have much of an opinion on that because there's not a point of error on it. And I'm not relying upon him having written it as the basis of our argument. We've cited plenty of authorities for the idea that if you have magazines, if you have child pornography, those things are admissible on the issues of motive and intent, regardless of where you got them. It's your possession of them that's important, not necessarily your having authored them. So we're going to move on. We're going to rely on our brief for the idea that the judge could find it relevant under traditional 404.1 and 404B. And what I really want to talk about is appellant's other argument, which was that the judge lacked the discretion to admit this because it didn't go to a contested issue. He was arguing that you have to actively contest an issue before you can get something in under a 404B theory. And the first point I want to make about that is that we've argued in our brief at pages 27 and 28 that this isn't preserved. Ultimately, when you drill down, he didn't preserve this complaint because appellant made he cited this general rule to the trial court, and the trial court and the prosecutor were talking about this court's cases that say there's an exception to that general rule, that when you have a specific intent case, the guy's intent is always an issue regardless of what he does. So when you're charging somebody with indecency, we have to prove whatever the defendant does, we have to prove that he had the intent to arouse or gratify a sexual desire. And that's discussed. The trial court discussed this court's Darby case, which held that just as in Darby, the defendant, like our defendant, you know, reached into the child's panties and under her bra. And this court said that you couldn't infer necessarily his intent from his actions, so that's his extraneous is admissible. And one case that I wish that we decided in our brief, and I just want to mention to the court, it's a case that ultimately started in this court, It's a case called Dixon versus State. It's at 2 Southwest 3rd, 263. And in Dixon, the defendant...
I'm sorry, 2 what? 3?
2 Southwest 3rd, 263.
It's 63.
I'm mentioning the opinion on rehearing from the Court of Criminal Appeals. And the defendant in Dixon objected to the state's attempt to impeach a witness with pending charges. And his theory of objection was Rule 608, which I believe is now 609. He said he complained that you can only use a prior conviction if there's a final conviction. And he said, well, this is just a pending charge. It's not a final conviction, so it's not admissible under 608. Look, the trial court and the prosecutor were discussing bias, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said, we're not even going to review whether it's admissible under this 612 bias theory because he didn't object that it wasn't admissible under that theory. And so because the trial court and the prosecutor were discussing this exception to the general rule that appellant invoked, and appellant didn't object that exception didn't apply for some reason, we don't think the court can review whether that exception is applicable. It's under the rationale of the Dixon opinion because, that's not what appellant's objection was. And I'd also point out that, as far as I can tell from appellant's brief, he doesn't argue on appeal that this exception to the general rule doesn't apply. So even if he'd have preserved it at trial, he hasn't preserved it on appeal. Now, we also believe that the trial court had ample discretion, even if appellant had objected at trial on this theory, to find that the bad act was admissible under this exception. As I mentioned in Darby, this court relied upon the defendant having touched the victim under her bra and panties to say that this exception applied. And in Morgan, the Court of Criminal Appeals decision, the court said that when the defendant touched the victim on her between her legs, that the state is allowed to prove his intent because he is in an indecency case, regardless of what the defendant does. We also mentioned in our brief the Corpus Christi decision in Sakara, which is unpublished. The interesting thing about that is that, like our case, the defendant was charged with both sexual assault and indecency, and the Corpus Christi court said that you can introduce the fact that the defendant had child pornography because it's admissible under the indecency case. One case which I just noted last night, and I somehow it seems compelling to me or interesting, is an unpublished case from the El Paso court, which I'll send the court a letter brief if you're interested in it. It was released on March 31st of 2005, and it's refused. The interesting thing about that case is that the defendant was charged with possession of certain chemicals with an intent to manufacture a controlled substance. And the Corpus Christi court said that, well, since that's a specific intent crime, it was all right for the state to introduce evidence that the defendant had track marks on his arm and told police that he was a methamphetamine addict. So it seems to be kind of analogous. The defendant possessing the story in our case certainly shows that he was interested in incest with his daughter.
Did that case have a name?
I'm sorry, it was Fulfer versus State. It's 2005 Westlaw 735012. It's Texap El Paso, March 31st, 2005. And the docket number, if you'd like, is number 08-03-191-CR. And the final thing I want to mention is on page 30 of our brief, we point out that the Court of Criminal Appeals has held that the state is always allowed to present motive evidence, and we think that this evidence, in our case, was very strong motive evidence. And we believe that this permission to always present motive evidence, it trumps this Owens business about it has to be a contested issue. We think that motive is always a contested issue because it'll be virtually unheard of for a defendant to contest his motive. And if you allow Owens to say that you can only present motive evidence when the defendant contests his motive, it's virtually never going to come in. And unless there are any questions, we would urge the court to affirm appellant's conviction.
If you use it as motive evidence, though, isn't there more of a requirement to show the relationship between the defendant or the ownership or the source of the writing?
I don't believe so. If he's got something that demonstrates that he's got a keen interest in incest, it seems to me that a reasonable fact finder would have every right to find that shows he's got a motive. that.
And did the defense argue at trial, though, that the prejudicial nature of this particular story?
I believe they did. But, you know, we actually had a, it wasn't a very strong case. I mean, we had a victim who was only corroborated sort of inferentially by her siblings. She waited quite a while to make an outcry. So we actually needed this pretty badly. Thank you.
Apparently your briefing was so overwhelming that it's left your opposing counsel speechless. So your case is submitted. We'll call the fourth case this morning.